All right. Voters, you have important decisions to make for the November 5th election. Tonight's forum is a great opportunity to learn about the candidates before you vote. Let's begin. All right. Opening statements. We will go in alphabetical order by first name. In your opening statement, please introduce yourself, tell us what neighborhood you live in, and share why you're running for sheriff. Please stay within the 2-minute time limit. Michael, let's start with you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Michael Wan. I grew up in District 11 in the Crocker Amazon Excelsior neighborhood. So why am I running for sheriff? First things first, I've dedicated my life to service. I served 10 years in the United States Marine Corps as a platoon sergeant. I served overseas in 2005 in the Iraq War. I've been a police officer in San Francisco with various agencies, to include the sheriff's office, for about 10 years. And why I'm here is really to serve San Francisco, to serve the community, and to be able to engage with our community and hear what they have to say and what they want out of their law enforcement. As mentioned earlier, law enforcement and the sheriff's office specifically is the place for the citizens to hold their elected official accountable versus the police chief. So I'm running because I want San Francisco to go back to how it used to be. I want San Francisco to be safe. I want to take part in being that team of people that will serve our community and allow our citizens to feel safe. Thank you very much.
Hi, good evening, everyone. My name is Paul Miyamoto, the current sheriff of San Francisco, and I'm very happy to be here. I want to start by saying thank you for your service, the service that you've given to the community and in the different capacities that you have are exactly the same reasons why I'm serving right now in my 29th year in the sheriff's office. I was born and raised here in San Francisco, grew up about 5 minutes away from here where I still live with my family, and I have been invested in San Francisco for my entire civil service career. I'm very proud to be the sheriff right now. I believe that the vision that I have brought along with my plan has been the right direction to follow for us in San Francisco as the sheriff's office and as a member of our public safety partners. We were challenged at the very beginning of my first administration within a month of becoming the sheriff. We dealt with COVID and the pandemic just as the rest of the world did. And the resolve, the resilience, the strength that the members of the sheriff's office showed in partnership and collaboration in carrying out our duties in those conditions and how we transitioned out with the rest of the community is an example of exactly what I bring to the table as the sheriff and the leadership that I share. Having been in this office for many years, growing up through the ranks, just being in the one office has given me insight and perspective that is very beneficial in leading this department. Going through challenges and adversity, going through short staffing, going through the short staffing now as the leader, I feel very in tune with our staff and what they are feeling and how they are dealing with that. So I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to lead the men and women of our department. I'm very grateful to be partnered with our city leadership in terms of how we can make this place better, and I'm happy to answer questions in this forum. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Paul, we're gonna start with you for the first question. So leadership often involves assembling and working closely with a team. Can you describe the qualities and characteristics you value most in coworkers and direct reports? How do you go about fostering a work environment that attracts and retains individuals with these attributes?
That's a great question, and I want to start by saying leadership is very important, but there's different types of leadership. It's not just about rank. And during the time that I've spent in this office, I've seen different types of styles of leadership. Right now, what I hope to focus on with the current leadership I have in the department is transformational leadership, where we are listening to our employees, listening to our people, listening to the community about what their expectations are of us as an agency and what role we play in public safety. We've gotten out of our comfort zone in some respects with the things that we have done recently, having deputies deployed out on the streets for Operation Safe Streets, having us in the community with our community engagement team are all ways that we've been more responsive to the community. The leadership retreats and the development that I've done for our staff in terms of our supervisors and managers are also something that we haven't seen before. So I hope to continue that as the sheriff.
Thank you. Michael.
Leadership, in my opinion, and I base a lot of it where I started in the United States Marine Corps, is very similar to the sheriff's. With law enforcement and the military being so closely intertwined as far as roles, leadership to me is making decisions, tough decisions, but also engaging with your subordinates, listening to different points of view, because not everybody has the same point of view. Everyone has different life experiences and can contribute to that. So what I would do differently is should I be honored to be elected the role of sheriff, is to survey our staff and see what adjustments can be made at different facilities and different units. And that can be used as data to actually move forward new policies and possibly new culture within the department. And I think that's the best way to be transparent with your various teams, whether it's the management level, the supervisory level, which are the sergeants, and with the deputies at the front line.
Thank you. Michael, we're going to start with you for the next question. How will you handle conflict and build consensus with coworkers and others in city government?
So the question is, how have I dealt with conflict? In the past 20 years, whether it was in the military or in law enforcement, conflict happens every day, as the sheriff would know. It's literally an everyday occurrence. How you manage that is really the biggest way of determining how you're going to succeed in whatever that conflict was. So for me, with conflict, I will like to just have that open conversation. It's important to let someone's voice be heard, whether it's someone you're dealing with on the street or whether it's a coworker that you're standing side by side with. Having that opportunity to listen to what their concerns are and then addressing it from the mission accomplishment level and the troop welfare level. And I'll explain that briefly. Mission accomplishment in law enforcement is public safety. We need to make sure we're serving our citizens and that our communities are safe. So as long as we know that we're agreeing that safety is the number one priority for our people, then that's the direction we're going. And as far as troop welfare, just knowing that you're going to take care of your people and have their back when things get difficult.
Thank you. Paul?
So conflict, and conflict as relates to not just what our job is and on the level of operations, but also conflict when you have philosophical differences in terms of how to do this job and how to approach public safety. San Francisco is a wonderful place which has wonderful values, and we've tried to instill those values into how we do the job in the sheriff's office. Our core values are service, pride, and professionalism, and there's many different ways in which you can interpret those words, but we prefer that our actions speak for those words, and that's what we try to do. When we talk about conflict amongst city leadership, sometimes there are differences on how to approach things, but the number one concern, as was mentioned by Michael, is everybody is looking out for safety. For us, it's not just the safety of the community, but actually the safety of those incarcerated, of whom we have custody and care of, and it's very challenging when you have conflicts on how to do that, but it's something that I bring 29 years of experience to handle.
Thank you. All right, next question. Do you support civilian oversight? Do you believe it provides transparency and accountability and improves community trust? Why or why not? You're first, yeah.
So what's very fortunate is during my tenure as the sheriff, we've implemented a oversight committee, which was what you just mentioned. It was mandated by the city through legislation. However, even before that, we had been working on creating an oversight board to get community input, to have people review our policies, review how we do things, and to have that community input to make sure we were transparent and make sure that people felt like they were a part of the decision-making process. In addition to that as well, we implemented the Office of Inspector General. That individual, who is Terry Wiley, is very specific to overseeing the job that I do as the sheriff and the job that we do as the sheriff's office. And we've worked collaboratively with them since day one. And we have that partnership, which I think San Francisco wants to see.
I 100% agree with being transparent with the community. A way of doing that, what I intend to do is engage through a social media or website, which will show the metrics of certain programs or certain, a way to evaluate programs that the sheriff's office is conducting and different goals that the office is trying to reach. So with that being said, I definitely feel that the best way to engage is to show the community what those metrics are for whatever program that's being dealt with. And with that, you can see the status of that actual program and how it's developing over time with the community being able to access that online. And as far as oversight, I think it's great to have that in order to show that the community their opinion is being seen.
Great, thank you. The next question, California AB 481, use of militarized equipment, requires the Sheriff's Department to report the number of times this equipment is deployed and used. The Sheriff's 2023 report doesn't address this statistic, nor state against whom the equipment was deployed. What is your position on transparently reporting the use deployment in next year's report? Michael, we're going to start with you.
I had a difficult time hearing some of that because of the background noise.
Do you want me to read it again?
Yes, please.
Okay. California AB 481, use of militarized equipment, requires the Sheriff's Department to report the number of times this equipment is deployed or used. The Sheriff's 2023 report doesn't address this statistic, nor state against whom the equipment was deployed. What is your position on transparently reporting the use and deployment of militarized equipment in next year's report?
So similar to the oversight, civilian oversight for the department, I also agree with reporting anytime a military weapon is used or deployed. I believe most police agencies have that shown on their website, so I would do that if it's not already there. I'm sure the sheriff already has that. So I think it's 100% the best way to conduct business, to show the community that we are transparent in all the actions that we're taking when conducting law enforcement and public safety.
Yes, if I understood the question correctly, it mentioned something about the report we currently have on there. And what I'm happy to mention right now is that we're in the process of presenting our next report, which will show that data and those statistics that aren't there now, because that report was actually the first time we ever put it out for the public to see and to be in compliance with AB 481. So we're on track to do that. I have a special interest in the use of the equipment that we have listed on 481, because I spent 16 years on our special response team and as a member of the emergency services unit. So we actually used the equipment that we have listed, and the use and how we deploy that kind of equipment is very important to share with the public so they know exactly what we do and why we do it. And what's very fitting for all of that is we're doing it to make sure people stay safe, not just our own people, but the community as well.
Thank you. All right, next question. What best practices currently exist, and what additional practices would you implement in San Francisco jails to minimize in-custody jail deaths? Paul, we'll start with you.
Great. I spent a good portion of my career dealing with different incidents that occur in jails. Death is the most unfortunate incident that we can deal with. And there are challenges not just in keeping people safe from their own behaviors, but also keeping our staff safe and making sure our staff aren't affected by the traumas of watching something like that occur. So we have a lot of things in place for our staff. Obviously, we have safety measures when they respond to incidents in jail. We always talk about what has happened subsequent to an incident through our after-action reporting and our hot wash debriefs. We have a peer support unit that is specifically designed to deal with the challenges of the traumas that our staff face. And when we talk about the inmates who harm themselves or engage in harmful behavior, it's our responsibility to make sure that they're in a safe environment. But sometimes we have to deal with that, and we try to create as safe an environment as we can by having constant observation and constant monitoring of individuals while they're in our custody and care.
Thank you. Michael?
So staffing and training, I believe, are two of the most important components to ensuring safe jail operations. First, staffing of the deputies. I understand the sheriff's office right now is having a lot of challenges, as are other law enforcement agencies. So getting support from City Hall and the mayor and the board of supervisors to boost staffing. How do you get staffing? Well, that's funding. The sheriff's office needs more funding. They've given some to the San Francisco Police Department. I believe firmly that a commensurate amount needs to go to the sheriff's office, so we can get deputies in the pods and all the different facilities in order. So more staffing means safer working environments. That's a fact. So that's number one, staffing. Training. I think training should be consistent. You should always step out of your comfort zone in an area that you're not maybe so comfortable within the training aspect, whether it's mental health, whether it's talking to people of different ethnic or gender identity groups. Training and staffing are the two most important things to keep jail operations safe.
Thank you. This one is related, so you get more time to talk about it. How can the Sheriff's Department ensure that staff and residents of the jail are kept safe? So, Michael, if you want to add anything?
Of course. So to further elaborate on staffing, and like I was mentioning, is funding, that needs to be the number one priority for San Francisco voters to let our city government know. Without your voice, we all know politicians and other elected officials have different visions. And that doesn't mean it's bad, good, it's just different. So you as the voter, if public safety is your priority and that's what you want, well, we have to put our money where our mouth is, and let's vote on that. Ensure we get extra funding for the sheriff's office so we can ensure safe jail operations. And if the jails are safe and run properly, then other aspects of law enforcement can be conducted in a safe manner. That means deputy on the street with other units such as warrants or safe streets. They know that they're going to be safe when they're conducting their business in the field. So that's what I would do.
So as a continuation of that, I spent 5 years in the training unit within our department itself, and it's not just the training itself, but what kind of training. When you have peer training on duty, when you have individuals on the shift or team working together with the training, in addition to our advanced officer training, which is department level, in addition to bringing other community-based organizations or groups in to be a part of that training, that's the whole reason we have the Oversight Board, the Office of Inspector General, to make sure that we have comprehensive training. We go through the same training as peace officers do in the state of California in terms of operational safety, tactical, constitutional rights, but the other types of training. We have a very diverse workforce, which reflects the community, which I think helps us to work better with those in our custody and care. We have 76% people of color in our department, which reflects what the community is inside of the jail and outside in the public areas. So I think that helps us also to interact and make things safer by making people feel more comfortable.
Great, thank you. All right, moving on. The Sheriff's Department relies on overtime to cover understaffing. How will you hire new deputies when it's difficult to recruit for law enforcement across the country? Paul, we'll start with you.
We have multiple layers of how we are recruiting right now. In fact, during my tenure, we hired a full-time recruiting officer onto our staff, which we've never had before. Just for comparison, the police department has anywhere from 12 to 20 officers assigned to recruiting. We have one on our budget. So we created a community engagement team, which is a collateral duty assignment where we put more deputies out into the community to engage in that recruiting. Our nationwide attempts at recruiting, we've sent people to other states. We also have a network, which is through multimedia and through our recruiter, who reaches out to educational institutions and athletic programs in educational institutions in order to get some more people interested in the job. We also partner with the military, with the PAYS program, to get individuals who are cycling out of the military, those that serve just as Michael did, and get them into the process before they discharge, so they have a job waiting for them when they get out.
Great, Michael.
So to address recruiting, first off, I would start by coordinating with the Sheriff's Union and take a look at what the numbers are, what the data shows as far as how is the region recruiting and what is the most effective way to recruit new officers. But underlying all that, all the teams and all that, I believe in order for somebody to want to work for your agency or for within your city, they need to feel that you're going to back them. There's a lot of challenges over the past few years as far as our profession, and that was a whole movement across the country. And that was the biggest detriment to public safety and to hiring quality law enforcement candidates. So minus all the recruiting methods and where we're gonna go, I think the message that I wanna push out there to possible candidates to come work for the San Francisco Sheriff's Office, I'm here to back you up. I'm here to help you grow in this department. But really it's just that support and that leadership that I feel has kind of gone away. Not here specifically, but just nationwide because of that movement in 2020.
Thank you. All right. What programs do you support for the continuing education of deputies? And ideally, how would these programs be paid for? Michael, we're going to start with you.
Continuing education of deputies, I believe it should just start at the basic level. We also have, we first off have the regular training, officer training, but also it's important that we diversify the areas in which our deputies are getting trained. So what that means is if a certain number of people want to attend, let's say an active shooter training that I personally enjoy taking because it gets you ready for those critical incidents where you need to be ready and everybody should be afforded that opportunity. So how to fund that, it would be a budgeting issue. I would coordinate with my budget and operations person and ensure we set aside enough money to get deputies the training that they need in critical areas. So that's what I would do.
Thank you. Paul?
Just to tag on to that, I'm currently an active shooter training instructor because of my background and experience. I advocate for that completely. We have an internal two-day course that we provide for our staff, and I like to have a balance between hands-on perishable skills training, such as active shooter training, in addition to things that make people think. We are very open right now under my administration in sending people out, detailing them out to other places for conferences, for training, for seminars, in order for them to get not just that information, but interactions with other agencies and develop networks. It's very important also to know that under our current training plan for the department, we have three different levels of training, that which is mandated, that which is we want to give to people, and that which is would like to have to give to people. So we have actually three different layers of training that we have to triage because we do have to balance the budget and the money that we spend on sending people out to those types of training.
Thank you. All right, moving right along. With city jails facing increased capacity pressures, including the reopening of a previously closed annex, how would you advocate for staffing and resources to handle rising demands? How would you communicate staffing needs and win the support of city officials? Paul, we'll start with you.
We're in the throes of that right now. And some of the challenges that we are currently facing are the challenges that are just were just asked in that question. I'm very proud to say that under my leadership, I've actually gotten a budget of $323 million for this fiscal year, which is the largest budget of the sheriff's office that's ever been granted by the board and by the mayor's office. It's nowhere near what we need, but it's a step in the right direction. We have funding for overtime. We have funding to address our staffing needs, but the most important thing is to get more people in place. So our next steps are going to be to push very aggressively for support with recruiting. You mentioned also that the jail space that we just opened, that will need not just more deputies, but we need infrastructure and we need renovations for the spaces that we have, which are very challenging because those are the first things cut during the budget process. So my advocacy that I bring to the table is the fact that I've been doing this job for a very long time. I've developed relations, and I'll leverage those relations to make sure we're funded properly in the coming years.
All right, Michael?
I can't help but say that that was a great answer, and I don't know what else to say. But so what I would like to add to that, considering the sheriff has dealt with a lot of challenges, is letting the city voters know how serious it is to not have a functioning jail facility for the deputies. I don't think the community knows how important that is from a standpoint where every day that a deputy's in the jail, understaffed, or just the facility, by opening older facilities, it makes things worse. And guess what? That means liability and lawsuits can happen. The sheriff doesn't want any lawsuits coming at him, nor would I. So I think the most important thing is educating the community on how serious of an issue it is to not have a functioning jail facility and to really press the Board of Supervisors and the mayor to allocate more funding to that. That's the bottom line. Whether it needs to come from state of California or within our San Francisco budget, but the sense of urgency is something that the city needs to know, and that would be the best way to address that.
Thank you. So I know we don't want overcrowded jails. So the next question is, what programs and policies would you support to keep jail populations low? Michael. Sorry, Paul. Michael first.
So how to keep jail populations low. The three things that I think of that San Francisco is dealing with is mental health, drugs. Actually, those are the main two. And how I would address keeping jail populations low is utilizing the other agencies within the city to address those issues. For example, mental health, we have multiple pods within the county jail that have mentally ill individuals, but that shouldn't be a place for that person. They need to go to a long-term medical facility that the city or the state should support because they don't belong there. They belong in a hospital. And likewise, with drug addiction, the root cause of that is substance. It doesn't necessarily mean they deserve to be in jail. They have an issue with substance abuse. So we need long-term facilities for mental health and drug addiction, and that needs to be outside of the custody setting, and that's how we can keep jail populations low. But the most important thing, first and foremost, is accountability as well. We need to ensure that our populations that are committing crimes, but, yep.
Thank you.
I'll try to keep it to a minute as well. Electronic monitoring, that is a big issue and concern that has recently raised its head in the media because we had a recent judge's decision which limits our ability to do that. And as the sheriff, I made the tough decision of saying we would not accept any more people. But that program up until that point was one of the ways that we were keeping the population down. In addition, I want to mention something that Michael had said about the jails themselves and the infrastructure renovation. We do need to build out those, and we do need to make sure that the community knows exactly what this is about. And that's about making sure we have some place which is safe, not just for people that are incarcerated, but for our staff as well. And so when that gets run down, it's very difficult to maintain safety at those levels. The other thing I'd like to say about what we would do to reduce the population has to do with alternatives to incarceration. And we support alternatives to incarceration with an entire division, our community programs division. We work with community-based organizations to get people into residential treatment facilities. And I will say more in my next time.
Thank you. Excuse me. Moving on to the issue of homelessness. As someone involved in public safety, what are your thoughts on balancing community concerns with the needs of those experiencing homelessness? How might law enforcement and social services work together to address this complex issue compassionately and effectively? Paul?
To answer that question, we currently work with the police department and the homeless work that they're doing right now in partnership with the Department of Public Works and the Department of Public Health. To go back to what we were talking about on the other piece regarding people with mental illness problems, we had a rehabilitation detention facility that was fully funded by the state, and the city chose not to take that money. And so now we're in a place where, as Michael said, we're dealing with mental health as one of the issues that are challenging to us. My interest is to have a locked care facility so withdrawal management can be an intermediary step that's not taken care of by people inside of the jails, but a partnership with the Department of Public Health in a different site and a different facility. In regards to the homeless problem, the services that we provide and our work with the homeless and HSH are part of what we're currently doing, and I'll establish that in our next statement.
Thank you.
So similar to what the sheriff just had mentioned, I think getting to the root cause of homelessness is where we need to address the issue. It isn't necessarily a law enforcement issue. It's not a crime to be homeless, but the real solution lies with, you know, the Department of Public Health, the Health Services Agency, and the Homelessness and Supportive Housing Department. I've talked to a number of the managers that work in those departments as a student at USF, and I was like asking, what is it gonna take to solve this issue? And one, building more housing, but really addressing the needs of the individual or the families. I don't think law enforcement needs to necessarily take as much of an active role as the community thinks. I think we're there to support in any legal matters and the safety matters in the field while dealing with homelessness, but I think the solution lies with the Board of Supervisors and the mayor to figure out how to utilize the other agencies and to get to the root cause of what's causing people to be homeless.
Thank you. This next question is one that's become a hot topic this election. Are you committed to preserving San Francisco's status as a sanctuary city? Why or why not? Michael, we'll start with you.
I actually did a paper on this a few months ago. So this is going to be a topic. I wish I had more than 1 minute, but the long and short of it is I do want to ensure San Francisco stays a sanctuary city, but the fact that there's going to be certain instances where violent felonies, violent crimes are occurring, sexual assault, sexual abuse, those instances, those crimes shouldn't allow someone to use the sanctuary city ordinance that the city has as an excuse to continue ongoing crime, if that makes sense. We need to hold people accountable, regardless of immigration status, especially if they are victimizing our citizens. And violent crimes and sexual crimes are probably the worst I can think of. But with the limited time that I have, I think it's a matter of managing both.
Thank you.
So I support Sanctuary City and I support the Sanctuary Ordinance because in the Sanctuary Ordinance is a specific carve out for the Sheriff's Office and the Sheriff to make decisions on actually contacting ICE when we do have situations, which Michael just brought up. We have articulated in the ordinance the ability when people do commit serious violent crimes or if they have a history of that and they are charged with those crimes again, to actually notify ICE once they've finished all of their local charge issues. And that's the only time that anybody in San Francisco can actually reach out and work with federal authorities on the immigration issue and work to making sure that individual, at least in the notification process, may or may not be picked up by the federal authorities on their immigration status once they're released from our custody. And that's something that's very unique just to the sheriff's office and the sheriff to make that decision. So we have that in place, and that's why I would continue to support that.
Thank you. All right. The Peace Officers Bill of Rights, or POBR, plays a significant role in law enforcement administration. As sheriff, you would be in the unique position of being both protected by POBR and responsible for implementing it within your department. How do you interpret the application of POBR to the office of the sheriff? How would you balance your rights under POBR with your responsibilities to ensure accountability and transparency within your department? That's a big question. Paul, you're up.
That is a big question, but having served as the lieutenant for the Investigative Services Unit, which is our internal affairs unit back then, I'm very familiar with POBR 3300 and the rights that are afforded are similar to constitutional rights afforded to accused people in the criminal justice system. This is an administrative protection given to people in any sort of disciplinary process or any time that they're actually speaking to an incident or a situation where there are allegations of misconduct or other behaviors which are counter to our policies and procedures. So POBR is extremely important to make sure not just that I as the sheriff have that because I make the ultimate disciplinary decisions in our department, but also make sure that our staff, from the deputy to the sergeant to the lieutenant to our command and management staff, all have a better understanding. And through the years, I've worked to make sure that there are educational processes involved in our systems to make sure that those rights are afforded to everybody and known to everybody as they work.
Thank you. Michael.
Very close to the sheriff's answer to that. It's very simple. So I actually served as a union director as well. So POBR is clearly defined, like our constitutional rights. I think the most important part about keeping transparency and accountability, but ensuring that sworn staff get the due process that is allowed to them or afforded to them. So I think it's managing both like anywhere else, knowing what your rights are and following the procedure as it's laid out. And from there is keeping the necessary systems in place and people informed on how things are going with the process.
Thank you. Okay, as technology advances, we're seeing an increase in autonomous vehicles and AI systems operated by corporations rather than individuals. Given the sheriff's responsibilities, how would you approach adapting practices to maintain public safety and accountability in this changing landscape, especially when dealing with corporate entities rather than individuals in legal matters? Michael, you are first.
That was a tough one. Can you repeat the last part about autonomous vehicles?
Sure, absolutely. It's a long question. Let me see if I can condense it. How would you maintain public safety and accountability in the changing landscape with all these new technologies, especially when dealing with corporate entities rather than individuals in legal matters?
So I think it's a collaborative effort that is going to require City Hall and the Board of Supervisors, as well as law enforcement agencies like the Sheriff's Office, to hold corporations accountable. For example, Waymo. I've seen all over social media the issues Waymo riders are having with individuals stopping vehicles, graffitiing these vehicles. And those issues, since you can't hold an individual accountable, need to be dealt with in the conference rooms and figure out the best way to ensure the safety of your riders, for example, in that Waymo example. So with that, I think a lot of discussion needs to be had and a lot of policies need to be put in place to protect our citizens as AI and as autonomous vehicles are driving around the city. And that's very important as technology grows.
It is very challenging, but we've had, and I've had experience in regards to actually dealing directly with autonomous vehicles. A few years ago, the fire chief actually asked for our support as public safety partners because while they were testing those vehicles, they were stopping. And what happens is they sometimes stop emergency vehicles from responding to places, which is a challenge and extremely dangerous from a public safety standpoint. So we wrote letters to the Public Utilities Commission in regards to that during the process when they're putting these cars out on the street. And we were in support of kind of making sure that these are more dialed back and more controlled. That's a direct experience. The other thing about AI, though, is there's a positive nature to AI. I just spoke to a company that approached us about monitoring our radio channels so that they can use AI to interpret and collect data specific to making sure our staff remain safe in terms of how they respond to different things. And that's just based on what they read off of those radio transmissions. So there are some things that will be helpful for us in the future as we look forward to using AI to make sure that we keep ourselves and the community safer.
Thank you. So that was our last question. I'm glad we made it through. For those tuning in digitally, it's about 95 degrees on this stage. So these candidates have very literally been in the hot seat this entire time. So it's time to share your closing statements with voters. Anything we didn't ask that you think people should know? We will go in reverse alphabetical order by first name, which means Paul is going first. And you will each have 2 minutes for closing statements.
Okay, one thing is that as the current sheriff, I am looking forward to the opportunity of continuing to serve, to take my experience, to take all that I have done in this first term and use it as a foundation for moving us even more forward in terms of not just safety for the community, not just the job that we do as deputies and as sheriffs and as members of the sheriff's office, but also to look forward to implementing some of the things in the original vision and strategic plan that we didn't get the opportunity to do because of COVID and because of that pause that we had. I feel that there is momentum right now under my leadership. I feel that there is a growth that has occurred, not just in terms of what we do for the community, of having more deputies out there, our Operation Safe Streets deployment, but I believe that we can position ourselves to take advantage of more opportunities. One thing that happens constantly throughout my career is people, because of what good work we do, people asking us to do more. And we've been limited in what we can do. I think with who I have been as the sheriff, what I have accomplished, and leveraging the relationships that I have with leadership in this city, I think we're positioned very well to take that next step to continue to help people in different areas that we haven't helped people before. And I look forward to that opportunity by getting either your first vote, ranked choice vote, or your second ranked choice vote on the ballot this November. I want to thank the League of Women Voters and everybody else for the opportunity to talk about these issues with Michael. And I also look forward to the support of the community in the upcoming election. So thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
I want to start off by thanking the League of Women Voters and the ACLU. And I actually want to thank Sheriff Miyamoto for allowing me to challenge him for his spot. I definitely know that it's not probably his most ideal situation with all the challenges that are being faced in the profession. But I just want to let the voters know that I'm somebody that wants to serve you. I want to hear what you have to say. I want to hear your ideas on how we can collaboratively make San Francisco the best city that it's always been. It's just a matter of how are we going to make adjustments? How are we going to move forward together and face the challenges that law enforcement is facing? How are we going to face the challenges in mental health, in drug addiction? I think it's not just one position that it's going to take. It's going to take a community and a city effort to make that happen. And it starts at the ballot box. So with your support, I would love the opportunity and honor to serve San Francisco as your next sheriff. I have the drive and the passion and the leadership ability to do so. I just need your vote and let's bring San Francisco forward and let's bring safety back to our great city. Thank you everyone for coming this evening. Thank you everyone watching at home. We appreciate your time and energy and this forum. Thank you very much, everybody.
Great. All right, so on behalf of the League of Women Voters of San Francisco and the ACLU NorCal, thank you to the candidates, to the voters, and to the Internet Archive for supporting this nonpartisan forum. To everyone here tonight, tuning in online or watching the recording, thank you so much for participating in our democracy by learning about your choices for the upcoming election. Remember to vote, please, please vote, and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to vote too. Thank you, and good night.